Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by Audible. Click on the Audible banner on the talkradioeurope.com homepage to download your free audiobook today. Terms and conditions apply.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's book show. My first guest is Sonia Beldam, who's one of the creative brains behind An Idiot Abroad with Ricky Gervais, Carl Pilkington and Stephen Merchant. She's worked with stars such as David Walliams, Victoria Wood and Dame Joan Collins. Sonia is the creator of the hit mental health blog Sonia's Mum, which highlights the issues of growing up with a hilarious but often hugely embarrassing mum whose mental illnesses weren't fully diagnosed until she was 80 years old. Sonia's career started as a BBC radio producer, working with people like Sir Terry Wogan and Giles Brandreth. Her children's picture book, Granny Franny's Big Red Bus, is inspired by her real-life experiences driving old double-decker buses around London. As you can tell, there was a lot to chat with her about, and I very much enjoyed it. Also joining us is Jenny Oliver, who wrote her first book on holiday when she was just 10 years old. She's now the best-selling author of The Summer House by the Sea and has just published her debut young adult novel, Chelsea High, which is the first in a new series set in a posh London high school. And finally on tonight's book show is Beatrice C. Snipp. That is the pen name for Larry Newstead, who wanted to publish under the name of his late mother. He put together a collection of short stories called Sands of Time after writing three books throughout lockdown. This is the only one to be published, though, so far. That's tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate the words that you could not find. Reaching for something in the distance, so close you can almost taste it. Release your inhibitions, feel the rain on your skin. No one else can feel it for you, only you can let it in. No one else, no one else can speak the words on your lips. Treat yourself in words unspoken, live your life.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Sonia Beldam, who's one of the creative brains behind An Idiot Abroad. She's also cast stars such as David Walliams, Julian Clary, Victoria Wood, Dame Joan Collins, the list goes on, in various hit TV series. She's also the creator of the hit mental health blog Sonia's Mum, which highlights the issues of growing up with a hilarious but often hugely embarrassing mum whose mental illnesses weren't fully diagnosed until she was 80 years old. She's currently writing two TV dramas, and she's with us on the book show. I'm surprised she has the time to chat to us about her debut children's book. It's called Granny Franny's A Big Red Bus, and it's inspired by Sonia's real life experiences driving old double-decker buses around London. Welcome to the show, Sonia.
Oh, lovely to talk to you.
It's great to have you with us, and so much I want to speak to you about. You're a very interesting woman.
Oh, I like to hear that. Thank you.
So it was you started in radio, first of all, didn't you? Radio production.
I did, yes, I did. I loved radio. I used to listen to it when I was younger because we didn't have a telly. My dad thought that the telly would get rid of all creativity, and so we only had a radio. So I marched up to the BBC one day when I think I was about 16 and said, "Hello, how do I work here?" And this woman, she said, "Do you have an appointment?" So I sort of talked myself into a job at the BBC and absolutely adored it. I absolutely loved it because it builds all the pictures in your mind, a bit like reading. I used to love radio dramas and hearing things that I could create my own images because the words meant so much. And I suppose that sort of then went on to a love of writing as well, where the same thing happens.
Yes. And then from radio, you were headhunted onto television, weren't you?
Yes, I was. Yes, it was a great move, actually, because it was at the time when the BBC were deciding that we needed to be both radio and TV savvy. This is well before social media and the big platforms that we know now. And I'd worked at Radio 2 for many years, so I absolutely loved that sort of middle-of-the-road music and high entertainment. I worked with people like Chaz and Dave. I'm sure lots of your listeners
yes.
remember Chaz and Dave. People like that. So but big high entertainment. And then, the TV world came knocking. And it was interesting because I'd never really thought that I would have a career in factual television. I always thought I'd end up in entertainment and music and the sort of my background. And then I was asked to help with a program about cars, of all things, and I thought, cars? I don't know anything about cars. I know how to drive one, and I know what colour they are. That's about it, you know. But it turned out that thanks to my dad stopping me having a television, this is an interesting story, actually, stopping me having a telly made me very, very creative in having to come up with entertainment ideas, you know, sort of entertaining friends or sort of putting on competitions and all the things that you do when you don't have a telly. And so I sort of didn't realise until someone pointed it out that I had quite a talent for turning relatively boring subjects into quite entertaining television program ideas. And that's how the sort of TV world sort of came knocking, as you say, because I came up with a car program idea called Panic Mechanics, and everyone just loved the title. Again, words creating a sort of story,
yeah.
Two words that sort of, you know, created an atmosphere. And then it carried on from there. So my sort of love of entertainment meant I loved all these fantastic characters and personalities and entertainers and intelligent, clever people who made amazing entertainment on screen, and thought, I wonder what I'd love to see them doing for television. And so then that turned into a career of thinking of ideas for particular personalities. So like when you remember Strictly Come Dancing, when John Sargent left in a flurry of publicity. I thought, what would I like to see John Sargent doing? And so I sort of came up with a big idea for him for ITV, which was called The Tourist Trail, which was just an interesting way of looking at how people visiting the UK see the things that we think are the big iconic places with very different eyes. And so it was a really interesting way of looking at us through the eyes of different people, and again creating a different vision through different perspectives. And then yes, and as you say, An Idiot Abroad was very funny. I was part of the team for that. I can't take whole credit, much though I'd love to, and I could retire, of course, if I could. But that was at a time when TV was thinking we need really famous people going on big passion journeys, you know, the J word, the journey. And we took an idea to Sky One that we said, like, here's somebody you've never heard of who doesn't want to go anywhere. Sat back and waited for the commissioner to look at us and she said, have you read our brief? We said, yeah, but we think you'll really like this guy, and it's exactly what you don't think you need, but hey, have a look. And as soon as she saw the video of it, you know, the taster, that's it, it was sold. So again, it's about looking at life from a different perspective. Not always what you think you want is what you need sometimes. So that's how my TV world has developed. And then, yeah, and drama more recently, just because that's always been quite a complicated nut to crack, as it were, in telly. But I've been collaborating with a big production company on a couple of ideas, and they're all based on the talent that we've got booked for the series. It's ideas that absolutely appeal to those people. It's part of their background, so we're using that to sort of get them inspired and get on side. So it's great. I'm having a fantastic time, loving it. Never thought in a million years I'd be doing what I'm doing now.
Oh, fantastic.
If you'd asked me 10 years ago, I'd have thought, yeah, I'll do another radio broadcast and I'll just be a jobbing producer. But luckily, my creative gene, thanks, Dad, is paying off now. So, and I'm working in telly, which is weird because my dad, I think, is a bit sort of, oh, I thought,
yes.
Hang on a minute.
What was the point of that upbringing?
What was the point of that? You made me brilliant at working in telly, Dad. So he's very happy.
And how about working with such brilliant creative geniuses and funny people, the likes of Ricky Gervais, Victoria Wood? I mean, it must be amazing to work with people like that.
Oh, it is extraordinary because they're all, I mean, what's so lovely, I didn't get a huge amount of time with Ricky. We spent a lot of time more with Carl Pilkington, who's the star of An Idiot Abroad. And Ricky is Ricky. I mean, he's just fantastic. You mention two words and off he goes. He's just an amazing force of original thinking and creativity, and he's learnt his brand, and it works brilliantly for him. Victoria Wood this was actually quite an interesting story. She, many, many years ago, had read this article, and it said on the, I think it was 2001, it's 100 years since the death of Queen Victoria, and this article said, it's been 100 years since the death of this amazing woman, and 3% of the world's land is still named after her. And I thought, that's quite a lot.
Wow, yeah.
That can't be right. It must be 0.3 anyway. So I did some research, and I thought, actually, if you look at it, you've got whole states of Canada, you've got Queensland named after her, you've got areas, you've got cities called Victoria, you've got Victoria Falls, you've got 101 Victoria Parks. I live next door to one in London where I live. And I thought, actually, maybe this is quite interesting. And so a few years later, when I was working for Tiger Aspect Television, who are a really huge production company, we had a good contact with her main big agent. And so I just casually thought, I'll throw it into the conversation as if I've just thought this idea out of, plucked it out of nowhere. But in fact, it had been in my mind for a few years, timing being of the essence. And I said, do you think we could ask Victoria Wood if she wants to go and visit all the places around the world called Victoria? Because I said, I have a funny feeling that her mother named her after Queen Victoria. Because there was an interview. Yes, it was really interesting. There was an interview with Victoria Wood ages ago, I found, in the BBC archive. She said, oh, well, all my friends were having, like, cassette players and posh things, and we had antimacassars and pictures of Queen Victoria everywhere, And she said, look, no, we weren't very modern in our family. We were a bit, And I thought, oh, she must have been named after Queen Victoria. So met her, and I said to Victoria Wood, said, oh, you're going to love this. I'm going to have you bent over this desk in the next 2 minutes. And it was hilarious because the boss I had at the time, who was in the meeting with me, was the son of a vicar. A very correct man, quite quiet on the creative spectrum, let's put it that way. So he looked at me as if to say, what are you saying, Sonia, for heaven's sake, this is a once-in-a-lifetime chance. Anyway, as it happened, I had this fantastic map of 1901, which was literally the map that was produced the year that Queen Victoria died. So it was full of the pink bits all over the map, which were the British Empire. And as I thought, Victoria Wood and I were bent literally over the desk looking at all the pink bits. I put flags everywhere. So here, 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 here. And all over the map of the world, you've got these places. There was a massive map. So we were indeed bent over the desk for at least 10 minutes. And I think at the end, my boss looked at me as to say, well, that went well, but you were very lucky.
Absolutely. Oh, wonderful. I bet she loved that. And what an amazing series came out of it.
Yes, it was. Victoria's Empire was a real hit. It was a big BBC one. It took a lot of filming because we literally had to go all over the world. And it was interesting because her take was that she wanted really just to talk to people who had been affected adversely and positively by the British Empire's imprint on the globe. And some of the people that she met were saying, well, had it not been for the amazing input, say, of the railway system in India, for example, then the tea trade might not have been quite so prolific, and different trade routes and merchants might not have had the future that they had. And then, of course, on the other side of it, you had the appalling stories of families whose families and relatives had been involved in the slavery trade, of course, that was still going on. Remnants of all that were still going on. So she took a very personal journey to look at that, something she'd always been fascinated by. And she said, you know, all my life I've always been slightly guilty, or all my life I've been slightly guilty of being British. So it was, for her, it was a great chance for her to go around the world and see these amazing places, and also talk to some incredibly interesting people with a big story to tell. And it appealed to her. So yeah, I think she always said that it was her favourite thing that she never thought of herself, which was a great accolade. I think I mentioned in the book, I think it says at the beginning, a very nice lady from the production company said, would you like to go all over the world? I thought, oh, I'm the very nice lady. That's exciting.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
She was normally generating her own ideas, so most of those programmes were her written ideas, so her scripts, you know, her thought process. So it was an interesting mix of giving her an idea to say, do you want to do this, yes or no, but also thinking, how do I present this to her so that she can come back and make it hers? And so she's feeding into it really in the early days. So she did sort of feel that she'd created part of the concept herself. But she said, so it was the best idea I'd never thought of. And I thought, that's very Victoria Wood. Yeah, it was great. She was amazing, you know, one of those people that just lights up your life. I'll never ever forget working with her. She was extraordinary.
Yeah, very sad loss to the entertainment world.
Very, and she kept that very quiet. You know, Celia Imrie, who was with her on Dinner Ladies and thing, and Acorn Antiques and all that. We've worked on a couple of ideas together, and she said she didn't even tell her how ill she was. She said it was a real shock. You know, in some ways, a very kind thing to do, so you don't put your friends and family into panic mode. On the other hand, I think people felt a little bit, it would have been nice to have supported her at the end, but then she was so ill so quickly, I think, that she just wanted to not bother anyone. She was that type of person. She was, I don't want to be a bother. You're thinking, bother us.
Yes.
But yes, it was a huge loss. I mean, it was somebody that makes you laugh, and someone who puts your life on a very different footing. Those people really are missed amazingly, because as we know, we like people who make us feel good. And when they disappear, those feel good people, when they're not around anymore, it does have an impact on everyone. So yes, it was sad.
And we will get to talk about the book and the buses and everything. But before then, I do have to ask you about your blog, Sonia's Mum, because that was a huge hit as well. Tell us about that.
Well, that's been amazing. Facebook, social media, bless its heart. When my mum was, you know, off the wall, difficult, funny, but embarrassing. Like, she'd heckle vicars at funerals when I was there, and she'd push me in front of brides and say, "Go on, stand in the picture." There'd be all these pictures of these brides thinking, "Who's this child?" You know, sometimes she'd put me in the back of a taxi on the way home from swimming. You know, we used to go to a swimming pool miles from home, and she'd put me in a taxi or a car, Hannah, actual car at the traffic lights, and she'd say, "Take this child back to Hendon," and then the lights would go green, and this car would have to go with me in the back. This driver going, what, hey, who? I always got home, but you know, she just in today's world, I think I would have been taken off her hands, you know. Anyway, but she was brilliant, but she was embarrassing, and she'd turn up to school with food I hadn't eaten and bring it in front of the class and slam it on the table, and you know, hey, her, you know, no wonder I'm not stick thin. She was really out of control until she literally started threatening a teenage gang with a toy gun, and they took rather badly to this idea, and luckily a neighbour had been monitoring her and called the police, and then she was actually taken in, properly sectioned. It was a very traumatic time, but she was sectioned and put into proper secure accommodation. they diagnosed her with 6 mental health issues that had never been diagnosed. She was very good at avoiding all of that all her life. So we realised she'd been incredibly ill, really, all her life, and all these bad bits of behaviour I just thought were her hating me were because she was doing her very best for, with the facility that she had, you know, and she was suffering from these huge mental... Anyway, so I started blogging about it mainly because a friend of mine said, your Facebook post, she said funny conversations about snippets with your mum now she's in the care home. A friend of mine's a comedy script writer and he's writing a character based on your mother. And I thought, oh, no, he isn't.
Yeah.
So I said, well, no, she's my crazy mum. She can't be anyone else's crazy mum. So I started the blog and sort of thinking, oh, have I got time for this blog, really? But I thought, no, I'll give it a go. I've never done one. I'll see what it feels like. And really, Hannah, it just took off. The number of people that came to me and said, I had no idea, really, probably quite how ill my own mum had been. And I've always put it down to her being difficult or, awkward and evil. And I realise now maybe she had mental issues that weren't discussed. Because, I was born in the 60s. And so in the late 60s, early 70s, mothers didn't declare mental illness because the worry was they'd be thrown into a mental institution and have the children taken away.
Mm.
So there was very much this sort of movement for them to sort of keep it quiet. And also, if they didn't seek help themselves, there wasn't any help available. My dad tried to get her help. But he said, authorities said, unless she seeks it personally, they can't intervene on someone else without their permission. So she sort of escaped the system. But the blog really took off in a major way, and it's funny. I mean, I have to say, people do say it makes them laugh and cry at the same time, because the stories, I mean, you were giggling at some of the stories. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, at my own wedding, she was heckling the registrar with very inappropriate comments. That was fine, because I'd sort of pre-warned the registrar. I said, my mum's going to be there. Yeah, expect the unexpected. And she was brilliant, though, of course. I absolutely loved her. And I told her how much I loved her when she was in the hospital. I said, I want you to hear this, Mum. I want you to listen. She's like, oh, yes, or cats and cheese sandwiches. I said, no, Mum, listen, just 90 seconds, just listen to me. Just look into my eyes and look at me, listen to me. And so she sat for the very, very rarely the occasions when she was silent. I said, Mum, up until now, I had no idea how ill and troubled you'd been. And you did the most fantastic job as a mother. Look at me. And she went, oh, I was a terrible mother. I did all these. I said, Mum, listen, look at me now. I'm healthy. I'm married. I'm really happy. I've got a great job. I adore you. You adore me. What more is there between a mother and a daughter? Isn't that fantastic? And it just, I could see it in her eyes. And I said, have you ever really understood how much I've loved you all these years? And she said, darling, I do now. And it was the most amazing moment, because for both of us, all the sort of angst and guilt and worry and sort of slight fury about the things that we had, a very tempestuous relationship, all that disappeared. And all we could do from that point on was just be loving mother and daughter together. And I think that's why when I've spoken about that on, a couple of radio shows, went on the Radio 2 show with Jeremy Vine to talk about that. And I had thousands of people writing to me to say, your story was very sad, but also very funny. It made us laugh, and it also made us think. It started a whole new conversation about, you can separate the bad behavior of somebody from the person that you can love 100%. So you've got someone that you adore them, the person, the human, you can love them 100%. And you can quite legitimately really dislike and not love their behavior. But if you separate them, it suddenly makes that relationship easier. And that message seems to have gotten through to people, and a lot of people are saying how much it's helped them. So that's the probably a book a book coming out after the...
Oh,
after
definitely, the definitely. Yeah, and what a lovely thing that you did to be able to separate that and tell her how much you loved her. That's so beautiful.
Yeah, it's such a nice thing. And I say to people, you can do that now. Why don't you do it? And they go, well, my mum died. I said, well, write her a letter.
Mm-hmm.
Or have a conversation, because you won't realise quite how liberating that is for you To let go of all the other stuff and just sort of see now, and you know, in a different perspective. Again, me and my perspectives, just a different take on it, you know.
Yeah.
And it's helped me amazingly. I mean, I would never have been as brave as I am if had it not been for my mum throwing me in the back of cars at traffic lights, sending me on holiday on a train. I had no idea. All I knew was I had to get off at Ramsgate. No idea what to do when I got there. I was six.
Oh, my goodness. That's crazy.
Yeah, and the reason she'd done that, it was not because she hated me, which I thought was she hates me. It was because she didn't have the money for two tickets.
Oh.
So she had one ticket for me, and she put me on the train, and she hitched down there, and I think I probably was at the police station when she came to get me about 6 hours later, you know, and now I can look back on it and think, oh, look at that behaviour, wasn't that wonderful? There's a woman who was doing socially inappropriate things because she didn't really understand, but she was doing it out of absolutely pure love.
Yes.
And I can see that now. 20 years ago, I might still be looking at it going, oh, that woman, how could she have done that to me? But now I'm looking back and thinking, no, it was love.
Yeah.
And it does give you a wonderful outlook on life when you can see those difficult people through different lenses.
Mm. Absolutely. So, buses. Seems like such an odd link, but you're also a bus driver around London.
Bus driver.
Of course you are.
The joyful thing about Radio 2, for you or any of your listeners have ever listened to Ken Bruce, so Ken Bruce on Radio 2 used to own a red bus company. So I think it was his retirement plan. And I knew him along with two or three other Radio 2 jocks. And I used to say to them, can I drive one of your buses? Can I drive one of your buses? And they said, yes, one day, yes. You know, go away, dear. No, they didn't actually say that. And then I think it was at Terry Wogan's memorial service at Westminster Abbey, and they drove up in the bus, and you know, a load of us got a lift there in the bus, and it was a very special moment for the Radio 2 tribute. And I said, no, seriously, guys, could I? I've never driven a bus, but I love big vehicles. Again, Mum had always loved, she used to flirt with bus drivers. She literally, a double-decker would turn up, and I'd be waiting at the bus stop going, oh, no, she's gone round the other side, which meant she was now talking to the bus driver about something inappropriate, holding up the bus, having a laugh and joke, and miraculously, we'd be taken wherever we wanted to go. I think she'd obviously maybe... How goodness knows what she said to the bus driver. We always ended up going off route and all sorts of things. Anyway, so they said, yes, you can drive one of our buses, but you need to get a license. So digging into my life savings, I got myself on a bus driving course and learned how to drive the bus. The most difficult thing, a 50-plus woman, when you think all your big learning has maybe sort of been in your 30s and 40s, learning how to drive a bus itself, the physical driving, I just loved. I took to it very easily. But it's a theory. Oh, my goodness, the theory, it's like taking the knowledge. It was so much to do, all the health and safety. I had to learn about wing nuts and oil levels and tire pressures and working hour directives. I was like, whoa, I just want to drive a red bus down London. Anyway, so I got myself a license, and then my very first trip, this was, I get goosebumps just thinking about it. Had to take a red Route Master bus, an old classic red bus, meet some clients at Marble Arch, and then drive down Oxford Street, and then down to the river and over Tower Bridge, back again to the Tower of London. Now, for a Londoner who adores London and was excited on their very, very first bus driving trip, can you imagine? I was just grinning from ear to ear. I was in the cab going, I can't believe I'm doing that. Oh, look, everyone's stopping and waving and smiling, and it's just... Yeah, so that's how I started that. And also, there's another reason for it, so the psychological reason, is that when Mum was kicking off and being really difficult, my mum and dad divorced when I was quite young, Dad would say, oh, I don't know why you're bothering to go down there again, you know. I wish that woman would just jump on a bus and... get the hell out of here. I've cleaned that up, by the way.
yes.
And I'd think, oh, I don't like the my favourite red buses being used like that. I don't like that analogy. So that was another one of the reasons. I thought, no, the red bus is now a source of joy and fun, and it's positive rather than this sort of negative thing. I have been driving brides and tourists and to the stag parties all over London and sometimes into the weird, wild worlds outside London where there are very low bridges you have to avoid.
Oh, yes.
And tiny country lanes, you know. It's like, okay, this is slightly more tricky. but just wonderful. And, of course, everyone hires an old rent London bus for fun stuff.
So yes.
You haven't got to deal with all the horrible things that drivers are dealing with now. You know, it's just all the issues with masks and difficult passengers and nervous people frightened, you know. As we say, anger is fear's bodyguard.
Yeah.
So people are scared and then they get angry and it comes out. So all the drivers at the moment I feel really sorry for. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to write this book because I can't drive the bus at the moment because obviously they're all off the roads. The various companies I drove for, there are no buses like that on the roads at the moment.
Mm.
Why don't I write the book, put all the joy and fun I had in the driving and sort of some of the mishaps, sorry, bus company, so a couple of the things that I might have done in my learning process, and just write a really funny kid's book about an awesome older woman who gets to drive a bus. I wonder who that's based on.
Yes.
It's gone down really well. People seem to like it. So it's, again, it's a first chance of doing it. I thought I'd probably be writing something more sophisticated. however, my childlike look on the world is obviously paying off, which is great. It's getting some really lovely reviews. I'm thrilled. And what's so lovely about it is that I had things come at you when you're not expecting, don't they, Hannah? Sometimes you just think, oh, I have no idea my words would have meant that to that person. I think the book is doing this. And then this wonderful lady, she said she runs a dyslexia clinic, and she said, the kids love the bright pictures in Granny Franny's Big Red Bus. They adore the pictures. They like the fact that there's a bit of rhyming and you've also got this invented this character called Thinkerbell, Thinker. Thinkerbell is the bus bell, who's the brains of the bus. And Thinkerbell knows everything. And she said the kids love that because they see the bus bell on a bus, and they're going, oh, if we ring the bell, we'll get to know things. So I'm giving children, without me knowing it, a different way of learning, which is so nice to hear that. And grannies and granddads and mums are buying it for their kids, and it's a different book and different story, and it's not about a child or an animal, it's about a really funny, awesome granny figure. And people are really loving it, so I'm absolutely thrilled. It's so nice to hear that. Again, never thought I'd be doing this in a million years.
No. And it's aimed at 3 to 7 year olds, isn't it?
3 to 7 year olds, yes. The three year olds love it because it's got funny rhymes, and then the 7 year olds, I mean 10 year olds and 11 year olds are reading it and finding it funny because there are grown up, you know, references in there. There are things that adults will find funny. But it's basically 3 till 7. So it's an early reader's book. It's quite easy to read, so there's hugely, let's put it this way, big, bold, colourful pictures. First time illustrating a book. I mean, I've done illustrations, but never quite as many as these, so that was interesting.
Oh, well done. You did the illustrations as well.
Yeah, I did the whole thing. That was very exciting summer.
Aren't you clever?
Oh, I know. Thank you.
That's brilliant.
It was good fun. I'll send you a couple of copies so you can give them out.
I'd love to.
But it is lovely. It makes people laugh, and I think grown-ups just, they don't find it too difficult to repeat read it. It's one of those that they still find it funny when they read it. So it's going really well. It's great. I'm really happy. So I'm on book two now. I'm just thinking of the next adventure.
Oh, also for Granny Franny.
Another Granny Franny adventure.
Ah,
yes.
Brilliant.
The adventure coming up based on an experience with my mum in a zoo. That's all I'm going to say.
That's all you need to say, I think.
All I need to say. Yes.
And 10% of sales is going to go to Buses for Homeless, which is a charity close to your heart.
Close to my heart, because it helps homeless people through a program where they It's, imagine a caravan park, but all the caravans are old reconditioned buses. And so they can live on the bus, on one bus, they eat on another bus, they have learning on another bus, and there's a well-being. So they turn these old buses into learning, living hubs, and people get to go through a program of rehabilitation, back into work, back into accommodation. And it's, and again, a lot of mental health issues there, of course, with helping people. So it feels like it's helping other people with mental health issues, plus the use of these beautiful old vehicles that for good. So, yeah, so Percentage going to them, they're thrilled, of course, because most of the fundraising for them has come to a bit of a halt, but picking up again now, thank goodness, I think, and the book is getting awareness for them as well, which is lovely for me to think that it's doing good as well as making people laugh.
Yes, you know, I love it. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, it's been a huge pleasure chatting with you, Sonia Beldam.
Oh, likewise.
Thank you so much for chatting with us today. If listeners want to get a copy of Granny Franny's Big Red Bus, it's available to buy on our website, tre.radio. And you must write the book about your mum.
Yes, I will. I will. It's going to be called Mum Controllable, 50 Ways to Embarrass Your Daughter.
Oh, fantastic.
There you are. Look out for
Yeah, do get in touch when that's out, because we'd love to chat with
I
you
will.
Again. That'd be fantastic.
That's lovely. Really great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Jennifer Oliver to talk about her young adult debut. It's the start of a new series. She's the best-selling author of The Summer House by the Sea and wrote her first book on holiday when she was just 10 years old. But her new series, the first in the new series, is called Chelsea High. Welcome to the book show, Jenny.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us. And how does it feel doing the first book of a new series? Exciting, I assume.
Oh, it's brilliant. I'd had it, Chelsea High, in my head for years. And actually, even before I started writing adult books. So I'm so pleased I finally got to write it and it's coming out now.
And how does it compare, writing books for adults compared to young adults?
It's not that different. I mean, one of the things I really like is that you can have a much more contained world with young adults. So, you know, the universe is around the school and their lives. Whereas I think with the adult fiction, you kind of have to build that into it. You have to create that. So like going on holiday or an office situation or something. Whereas I think with teens, it's a much more condensed world, like a boiling, you can reach boiling point much easier.
Yes, no, that makes sense. And have you kind of remembered your own school days? Has that had an influence in the book, do you think?
Oh, like without a doubt. I think what you do as a writer is you take things that have happened to you and just ramp them up to a certain level to give them that conflict and that interest. And, you know, I went to all girls school. We were separated from the boys' school next door by a wire fence. And so you can imagine what break times were like, or, you know, it was fun, but it was very, you know, it was bitchy, it was cliquey, it was really high pressure. And I definitely drew on things like that when creating Chelsea High.
So tell us about Chelsea High. What's it like?
Well, it is a rich, very wealthy school in the heart of Chelsea. It's a red brick building. Based it on the Chelsea Hospital, where they have the flower show every year on that kind of land. And it's just a place for like the privileged and the elite. And I wanted to throw someone into that environment who would be completely out of their depth in every aspect. And so I came up with the character of Nora, who comes from like a little idyllic island on the Thames. And her life has been completely destroyed. And she discovers she has these rich grandparents and they enroll her at Chelsea High. So she turns up on the first day, like completely, you know, like a fish out of water.
Oh, I can imagine. They're very different worlds, aren't they?
Yeah. And I think for her also, she hasn't known anything about this rich heritage that her parents had kept from her, because they had wanted to go and live this bohemian life on an island, living on a houseboat. She'd, you know, it'd all been lovely. And her dad actually gets arrested as part of a Ponzi scheme where he had taken money from everyone on the island and bankrupted it. So they have to leave. They have to flee. So everything she knew up until this point has gone. And it's quite a high profile trial. So she's kind of ripe for a bit of bullying at the school, and just discovering about herself. I think it's a kind of to show about like the end of that childhood innocence when you're going in and having to face your teenage years.
Yes, gosh, it's a big thing, moving schools, isn't it? It's one of those things that can often make or break a child. You know, some children thrive in new environments and making new friends and find it all very easy and exciting, but other children can really struggle.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I knew, you know, I didn't change school, and I used to watch people who did, and I didn't know how I would do it. And yeah, I think it's really difficult if it's not something that comes naturally, and if you have something lovely that you're leaving. And I also didn't want it just to be about her relationship with her friends. For me, it was quite important about her relationship with her parents as well, because I think quite often in young adult fiction, that's forgotten. And this is quite a kind of complex relationship, because she has always really trusted them and looked up to them. And actually, they've been lying. And it's that realization that the good people in your life can sometimes do bad things.
Yeah. Yeah. So tell us about some of the other characters at the school.
Well, there's the kind of Queen Bee Instagram influencer, Coco Summers, who, you know, is her nemesis, really. And then there's Ezra Montgomery, who actually is the love interest and kind of saves Nora as well as her saving herself. But it's that relationship. He's kind of an outsider. He was, you know, one of the main guys in the school, and actually he has got his own issues that he's dealing with at the moment. And as two outsiders, they kind of find each other, you know, in this glossy place.
Yeah. And did you plan from the start that it was going to be a series? Did you think that it would make a good setting, this school?
Yeah, I knew I wanted it to be a series. I knew that I wanted to also trace. So it's also tracing what happens in her life. So I'm at the moment currently just editing book two, and it was seeing what happens with relationships, that it isn't just kind of happy ever after at the end of something, that you then see what happens, and then you see how she's surviving with her dad not being around, and just all those complexities and what it's like, you know, a couple of terms into somewhere.
Mm. And do you get to tackle all the subjects that young adults have to face in terms of puberty and boys and things?
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's about kind of, while the kind of the school is all glossy and perfect, I think it's really about those emotions that in this book for everyone are kind of messy and difficult, and they're struggling. And hopefully that everyone can find something of themselves in it, and it can give them either some kind of relief from everyday life, or also some answers and things that they're struggling with.
Yeah. And do you have to be aware, if you're writing books for young adults, is there a particular age that you have to aim at and therefore conform to in terms of the writing style?
Well, this is probably slightly at the younger end of the young adult market. So I've always got that firmly in mind, and I can always talk about it with my editor if, you know, if there's things I want to push or what I think is appropriate.
Mm. Okay. So sort of 12 plus.
Yeah. But, you know, all my friends are reading it, so
Well, if people want to get a copy of Chelsea High, it's available now on our website, tre.radio. It's by Jenny Oliver, who we've been chatting to. Jenny, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from Spain, near the Mar Menor, is Larry Newstead to talk about his book Sands of Time, a collection of thought-provoking stories. He wrote it along with two other books during lockdown. Welcome to the show, Larry.
Yeah, nice to meet you.
Nice to have you with us. Thanks for joining us. So you were busy during lockdown?
No, I had nothing to do. That's why I wrote the stories.
But yes, you were busy writing the stories.
Ah, yes. It wasn't busy writing them, because writing's very easy. I can do it with a pen and paper in a matter of hours, but it took days and weeks with one finger on a computer to print it out.
Yes, yes, but three books, that's impressive.
Yeah, well, the second two were longer.
Yeah, so you must have spent a lot of time writing then. Was that your main focus?
No, I actually didn't spend a lot of time, probably an hour and a half, 2 hours a day. I say writing's very easily, it's just the typing out on a computer afterwards takes a hell of a long time.
Yeah, but three books in the space of a couple of months, not many people can achieve that. I'm trying to compliment you here, Larry.
I probably don't take compliments very easily, the wife says. Well, not really, it depends if you read the book and enjoy it. If you read the book and enjoy it, yes, it was done very well. If you don't enjoy it, then obviously it's not one that you would think you took a lot of time over. Though I must admit, some of the stories in the one that's printed are quite descriptive in manner.
Yes. So the short stories then, what was the kind of inspiration between for these stories?
Nothing. The only time I could go out during lockdown was with the dog in the morning. So when it was about 6 o'clock in the morning, I took the dog out and just thought as I was going around. When I come back, we had a cup of coffee, I went upstairs and wrote half a dozen pages.
And do you have a particular style? Do you like to write comedy or serious things or crime? How would you describe the stories?
The one that's been printed is in the style of Edgar Allan Poe in his short stories. I don't know if you've ever read any of his.
Mm-hmm. How would you describe them, though?
In the style of Edgar Allan Poe, thought-provoking, give you something to think about.
Okay. And what about the characters? What kind of characters do you like to create?
In the other books, there's two different books. One is a fellow who goes through life really doing nothing. And in the other one, it's a lady and gentleman who find themselves in a predicament that they can't get out of.
Okay.
That's not being very descriptive, is it?
No.
No.
Can you tell us more?
I'm not very good at doing an interview, but carry on. I will do my best.
So what more can you tell us about the other two books? But they're not published, the other two.
No, no. If this one sells and makes a few pennies, I'll have the other ones published.
Okay.
One's about an erotic lover, and the other one is about two people who meet a creature that comes in from space. Gets lost by an alien who leaves it, can't find it, and it changes the world.
So very different stories, all of this.
Completely
then. You obviously have a very imaginative mind.
So the wife says.
So the book that people can buy is called Sands of Time. So can you tell us about some of the stories in this book?
Well, it's a collection of, I like to think, provoking your mind into think things. One's about a magic pair of trousers, which, not to give too much away, are unbelievable. And they get taken away, and it's not the store. It's not the trousers. It's actually his right hand, but that's irrelevant. One of the other ones is a super nose, which is someone who loses their sight and their senses take over, and he has a super nose. One's about a soldier who's lost in time after the Second World War, and he's never thought of until he actually dies. Several stories like that, just different ones that took me on the particular mornings when I took a dog for a walk.
Mm. And did you write them all in one go when you started a story? Would you always finish it straight away?
Yeah, it was always easy. I mean, they're not very long. I mean, the longest one, I think, is My Trousers, which is about nine pages long. So the sort of story you can read during a cup of coffee or a tea break or...
Mm.
Half an hour's break at lunchtime, or just put the book down after reading one and pick it up later.
Yeah. And have you done writing things like this in the past? What's your background?
1965, I think, was the last time I wrote anything. I'm an English teacher, lit and language, called Mrs. Thompson, who used to like reading my stories. But that was a long time ago. It was the last time I wrote anything.
Mm. So how did you find it, having not written for such a long time?
Odd. Not so much writing the stories. I'm no good on a computer. If you give me a computer, I can't use it. I have to hit it with a hammer. I'm totally hopeless. So it was spending days on days on days pressing keys with one finger, which is now about half inch shorter than the other.
But you did it.
Eventually, yeah. No help from the wife.
Right. Well, it's a great collection of stories. It's called Sands of Time, and it's by... So I have to ask you about who it's by, because it says on the book, Beatrice C.
Oh, it's my mother.
Snip.
Mother died in 1963 of ovarian cancer. And when I went to get it published, they said the two books have to go to the British Library. So I thought, my mum's name, I'll put it in her name, because no one's ever going to remember her except for me. Her name's there, sort of in the book, whether any gets sold or is there for eternity.
Yeah, that's a lovely idea. So Beatrice C. Snip is on the book.
Correct.
Okay, fantastic. Well, we put the book on our website, so listeners get a copy from there if they want to get a short story book to dip in and out of. It's a great idea. It's called Sands of Time.
I've also put the email address inside of Beatrice C. Snip in case anyone reads any of the stories and they wish to get in contact and ask anything.
Okay, fantastic. Good idea. Larry, thank you very much for joining us and best of luck.
Thank you, Anna.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this programme, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.